Hi, reader. I'm Cindy Burnett. Welcome to my award-winning podcast, Thoughts from a Page, which is a member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. On the show, I chat with authors whose books I have enjoyed about their new releases, and I give you a peek behind the curtain of the publishing industry with my Behind the Scenes series. With so many books coming out weekly, it can be hard to decide what to read, so I find the best ones and share them with you. If you're looking for a community of readers, bonus content, and a chance to read books before they hit the shelves, I hope you'll consider joining my Patreon group, which is filled with a wonderful bunch of book lovers. The link to join is in the show notes. Today, Kara Hunter returns, this time to talk about All the Rage. As anyone who follows my show knows, last year, her book Murder in the Family, which is a standalone, was one of my top reads of the year. I absolutely loved it. And now that William Morrow is releasing books 3 through 6 in her Adam Foley series, I knew that I needed to start reading them. While All the Rage is book 4, each of these can be read as standalones. I thought this was absolutely phenomenal, and I highly recommend it. Kara is the author of the Sunday Times bestselling crime novels starring D.I. Adam Foley and his Oxford-based police team. Close to Home was a Richard and Judy book club pick and was shortlisted for Crime Book of the Year in the British Book Awards for 2019. Kara's novels have sold more than 1 million copies worldwide, and the TV rights to the series have now been acquired by the Fremantle Group. She lives in Oxford on a street not unlike those featured in her books. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor, so while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.
Welcome back, Kara. I am so glad we're getting to talk again.
It's fantastic. Yes, and so quickly after the last one.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking, because usually it's a year or two between conversations. But because you have this series coming out here, we get to talk in a much shorter span of time.
I know. It's fantastic. I've got about 4 books coming out in the space of a year.
I know. It's pretty crazy. It has to be wild for you. So I thought what we would do with this one is, since this is a series, that we might first talk about the series generally, and then we can talk about the most recent book after that. Does that sound good to you?
Sounds good to me.
So why don't we just start out with you talking a little bit about the Foley series, and then we'll talk about All the Rage.
Sure. Okay. Well, it goes back now. I was writing the very first one back in 2015. So this is some time ago. That one was called Close to Home. And it started very much not as a series. It started not even as a police procedural, though that's one of the things it gets classified as. It started as a story about a missing child with a really big twist. And I'm not going to spoil it, so don't worry anyone, I'm not going to spoil what the twist is, but that's what people tend to talk about with that book. I got the idea for the story in terms of the twist. So after that, it was quite an interesting experience, sort of technically, because it was all about creating a family and a community and a world in which this little girl would go missing under those specific circumstances. So of course, it being a story about a missing child, then inevitably there was going to be a police investigation. Obviously, that will happen every time that that situation arises. So Adam Foley, the central detective in the series, he sort of came to be as a piece of plot machinery. He was an essential thing for that book, rather than me approaching it as, oh, I want to start writing a series about a detective. I mean, I didn't know for a start whether I would even get more than one book out of that. I certainly didn't have it in my mind when I was writing the first one. So in a way, I think it was quite useful, because it meant that his character evolved without any pressure on it. So that by the time I started to look at writing the second book, which is called In the Dark, he was established, his team were established, but there'd been no pressure on it. It evolved quite organically. I mean, in terms of the setting, it's set in Oxford in England, which is where I live. And thanks to things like Inspector Morse, everyone knows what Oxford looks like. It's a very beautiful city. And like most university cities, has a very interesting dynamic in terms of the mix of the population. So it's a very good place to set crime, I think. Perhaps that's why Colin Dexter set so many here as well. Though mine very much are more modern than Morse. I mean, Morse is lovely, but quite nostalgic. I remember being here at the university when those first TV episodes were being made, and they were quite sort of nostalgic and chocolate boxy even then, and they certainly are now. It's a much edgier place now than it was then. So my series is very much looking at the real life of the city, the more gritty angles, and not so much the university. Sometimes there are university angles in my series, but not very much. I avoid it if I can, because that's not really what I'm interested in.
So the series was published in the UK as each book came out and as it became a series. And now William Morrow is publishing books 3 through 6 every couple of months. Is that correct?
That's right. So we've had No Way Out early part of this year. That's the third book, which begins with a house fire in one of the more prosperous parts of Oxford, in which two children are found alone in the burning house. So that has quite a traumatic beginning, that book. And then All the Rage, which is the one that's just out now in America, that begins, funnily enough, that begins with a sort of link to a real life case, because when I was thinking about stories to write about for that book, there was a quite famous case here in Oxford where a young girl had been found sort of wandering in a dazed and rather distressed state in part of Oxford. And there was a big sort of hunt for somebody who had apparently abducted her and then dropped her off, and she was found wandering. And it went on for weeks, and of course, quite a deal of distress, as you can imagine. Parents are very worried about their children, that sort of thing. And then quietly, about 6 weeks later, there was just a very, very short announcement from the police to say that, in fact, they were no longer looking for anybody because they basically believed that nothing had actually happened. And I remember thinking at the time, what an extraordinary story, and thinking about the girl in that particular story and wondering what had led her to be in the situation where she found herself. So this book isn't about that girl. I don't know who she was, but it is about a similar sort of situation. And that's the setup for All the Rage. We find there's a girl found in a distressed state by the side of the road.
And then it unravels from there with so many twists and turns.
Yes, it does. And it is actually one of my favorites in the series, because I was able to look at some of the issues that I find really interesting with this particular one. I'm sure we'll come onto it later, but the title is a reference not just to All the Rage in terms of fashion, because the girl who's found by the side of the road is a fashion student, but rage in the sense of online communities of hate that we now are encountering in sadly ever more obvious places. And this whole idea of sort of pent up frustration and anger that does come out through some of those communities. So this story gave me the chance to look at some of those issues.
I definitely do plan to ask about the title later, because it is the perfect title with the dual meaning that you just described. But before we do that, the first question I had was, why aren't books 1 and 2 coming out with William Morrow? Did they already come out before at some point here?
They did. They came out about the same time as the series started in the UK. So Close to Home and In the Dark are both available in the US already, but probably only, you'll find them only in ebook form now, but they are there. So if you want to start from the beginning, you can. But I've written it very carefully, each book, so that the crime story within each book is a standalone. So you don't have to have read all the previous ones. But if you want to follow the personal lives of the detectives, then you can do that by starting at the beginning and sort of going along with them.
And I do agree with that. I think each book stands alone. You fill in enough of the backstory about the characters to be able to pick up any of them. But if people really do like to follow the story from the very beginning, they can start with Close to Home.
They can.
Great. And then do you have any more coming out in the series at some point?
Yes, I do. So Fawley 7 is going to be out early next year. I'm writing that one at the moment. So I had quite a big gap, obviously, between writing the sixth book, which is Hope to Die, which was set in 2018. And this new one, Fawley, is actually being set in 2024. So I've taken the opportunity of the gap I've had because I wrote Murder in the Family in between those two books to actually propel everyone forward a bit, which is quite nice because it gives me the chance to shake things up a bit. And as you can probably imagine, one of the things you have to be careful with in a series is not to let things just start to get a little bit samey. And so I've been able to change things quite a bit simply because of the passage of time. So Adam, for example, has been promoted in the intervening years. The other thing it's allowed me to do is completely avoid lockdown and COVID and everything else, because I definitely didn't want to write a book set in COVID. I just didn't feel that that was the right thing to do. And I'm not interested in reading those sorts of books. So I suspect a lot of my readers won't be either. I was very lucky. I was able to leapfrog that whole thing and then just go straight into 2024.
Oh, that is exactly right, because I think it is too fresh still for a lot of people. Plus, it won't really serve any, you know, it won't serve any purpose in your stories to have to worry about masks and lockdown and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, it's just too soon. It'll be interesting in a few years' time. And there have been some good books written set at that time, but I just don't have any appetite for doing it myself.
I totally get that. Well, you have very intricate but clever plots. And I can't remember when we talked about this last time. Do you pants or do you plot?
That's a really good question, because as time's gone on, I've done less plotting. And I think we did talk about last time with Murder in the Family, that was the first book I'd ever written where I didn't know who the killer was before I started. I had a short list, so I had a sort of general landing territory in my mind, if that makes sense. But I didn't actually know who it was going to be. So I had the confidence, I suppose, after having written a few books now, to let the story tell itself to me. Whereas at the beginning of the Fawley series, and actually up until quite recently, I've been a real plotter. I've just sat down and I've written a very detailed synopsis. I've even sometimes gone down to sort of scene by scene analysis. And I felt it was quite helpful in that it was like a security blanket in a way that, you know, so you knew it was there and you knew that you could get from the first word to the 100,000th word and actually the story would hold together. And that does have a use, I think. If you go the other route and you just decide to, you know, sit down in front of the laptop and go, there's no real telling where you're going to end up. And it might end up in quite a complicated place in terms of unraveling your plot. So I tend to plot more with the Fawleys, though I'm doing it less with the seventh book that I'm writing at the moment. But it has done exactly what I suspected it would do and go off in some different directions because I allowed the story to have more freedom, if that makes sense. So it's got some pluses and some minuses, I think.
Well, as I was reading All the Rage, I kept thinking about that because I was like, there are a lot of moving parts, some really great twists. And I couldn't imagine that you could sit down and just write that because there's so many different parts that have to come together.
You're absolutely right. That one took a lot of plotting. It's part of the fun, actually, doing that. I do enjoy creating a story that's going to be a bit of a switchback ride. And you don't want your reader to guess what's going on too soon. I don't mind if they guess close to the end, but you don't want them to have worked it all out too early. So I spend a lot of time trying to think about ways in which I can have some fun with the plot and, you know, pull things in slightly different directions, which might, again, particularly with this book, and you'll know having read it what I'm saying, it's quite thought-provoking, this one, in some ways, and some of the assumptions that are made about what's going on here are completely wrong. But hopefully, once you get to the end, it does, in retrospect, it makes sense. It might not be a common thing to have happened, but it is something that makes sense, but it raises interesting issues along the way.
I agree with that completely. And numerous issues, not just one or two. There were a variety of things that really made me think. And ever since I finished the book, I'm like, oh my gosh, that was so well done.
Oh, well, thank you. Coming from you, that's a wonderful compliment. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that I loved about Murder in the Family so much was the mixed media format. It's just so well done. It's so clever. It's such a great way to integrate some of the things that you're trying to get across in your stories. And you create those yourself, even the formatting, right?
I do all myself, actually, Cindy, partly because I love doing it and it's one of the treats. I save it to the end. So I have a treat waiting for me when I've done all the hard graft of a first draft. But also because I'm such a sort of a bit of a perfectionist about the way things look and making them look authentic. So it looks like the right thing. It looks like what a podcast would look like. It looks like what a particular newspaper article would look like. So I don't want to give somebody else the sort of stress of trying to reproduce that and then me saying, oh, no, it's not quite right. So I do it myself. And then I know that the only person who's going to get a hard time is me. But yeah, I do enjoy it. And as you can see, the whole mixed media approach, well, when I first started doing it, they didn't call it that for a start. When I was doing it in close to home, that started actually with that story, because with that story, of course, it was a missing child story. It meant we had to have a police investigation, as I've already said. But the other thing that I knew straight away would be part of that developing narrative was going to be social media, because that's what happens. We all know that's what happens when a child goes missing and it becomes public knowledge. There are things like the parents do an appeal to ask for the child to be returned. And social media blows up, and usually not in a good way. People are making judgments, almost always negative about the parents. They're coming up with theories, some of which are quite harmful and damaging. So I knew that was going to be a thing. So I decided to actually bring those voices inside the book rather than dealing with it in sort of tangential way. So we actually do have in that book, we have Twitter feeds of people commenting on what's going on, making judgments about the family, some of whom are just completely wild speculations and hurtful ones. And that's what happens in real life. But some of the people who are watching are also quite observant and coming up with things which perhaps even the police have missed. So there's the two sides of social media there. But I particularly wanted in that book to look at this whole phenomenon of what happens in two families when something like this occurs and how toxic social media can be. I think that's something that you can actually explore through crime fiction very well. And it's a good way of shining a light on that.
Well, I thought that was fascinating when we talked about it before. And then I noticed in your acknowledgements this time that you even say thank you to the publishing team for letting you do all of that.
Yes, I know. I'm not very easy to work with, I think, because I am a little bit of a perfectionist. And I do like to see the way things are set on the page and do it properly. But I think once they get used to me, it's okay. But the whole approach, I mean, starting, as I say, with Close to Home and the Twitter feeds, and then I had news feeds in that as well, since the two things seem to feed off each other. And then as time went on, people loved it so much that I started doing more of it. So in the dark, that we have, if you like, the prototype for Murder in the Family, because we have a Netflix-style documentary talking about an old case which comes up in the course of the investigation for that book. So we have some of those episodes in there. We have a crime scene drawing in that one as well, which was done by a real life CSI. So that was huge fun. And then in No Way Out, there's a fire scene report. I said the book starts with this terrible house fire. And I went and spent some time with the fire guys in Oxford, and they showed me the sorts of reports that they write when there's a suspicious fire. And I use the same format for mine, which, and this just, you can imagine, a nerd like me, I thought this was just terrific. And then we go on, and there are exactly the same sorts of things in All the Rage and in the one after The Whole Truth. There's a podcast series. So the more I do, the more people seem to love it. And that's why we ended up with Murder in the Family, where I just abstracted myself from the process entirely and did it all through different types of mixed media.
And I remembered we talked about that, and both how you got to writing Murder in the Family and also that you did all of your own mixed media presentation on the page. And so two of my book clubs read Murder in the Family, and I was telling them all about it, and they were completely enthralled.
Oh, how wonderful. That's lovely to hear.
They thought it was very cool that you had done all of that.
Yeah, I do enjoy it. As I say, it's a bit nerdy, but there you go.
Well, I'm nerdy as well, so I love it.
Hi, I'm Emma.
And I'm Joe.
And we're the Professional Book Nerds. Two Mondays a month, we interview authors and talk about their upcoming books, what drives them, and their go-to order at the cafe.
On Thursdays, we share recommendations and dive into topics readers face, like how do I actually read the books on my to-be-read list?
You can find the Professional Book Nerds podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn more about us? Our website is professionalbooknerds.com, and you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at ProBookNerds.
We hope you'll come and listen, and as always, happy reading!
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.
What has it been like revisiting these stories?
You know, it's really interesting. Sometimes, you know, I'll pick them up and I'll just read a page or two and it'll surprise you. I'm sure other writers have the same experience where that you'll read a passage and you think, I don't even remember writing that. But it's lovely to actually go back and be talking to readers about them again, because of course I'm getting readers from America talking to me about these backstory books. And it's lovely to have those conversations, because I had them a while back when the books were out in the UK. But to now have a whole different, almost a different generation in a way of people coming to them and having their own views and responding to the characters and the stories. It's really interesting. And it's been wonderful for me, particularly now I'm writing another Fawley, to just get that sense of the love that there is out there for some of the characters. So that's been very heartening, actually.
I was just thinking that, and to be immersing yourself in the earlier books as you're writing book 7.
Yes, exactly. And getting straight back into the environment and the people and the dynamics within the team, because that was one of the things I did quite deliberately with the whole Fawley series right from the beginning, was that it was always going to be a team effort. I mean, you have to have a central detective, because that's what, you know, the publishers hang their hat on, if you like, and it gives a sort of name for the series to be and held under. But really, all policing, and especially in this country, I think a bit more even than in America, it's a team effort. I mean, detectives don't, over here anyway, don't go around in pairs. They are a part of a team, and they're quite big teams as well. So in order to make it feel authentic to what would really happen, which is really important to me, then it had to be a team effort. So there's a lot of times where it isn't Adam that comes up with the, you know, the big idea or the big revelation, as you know, sometimes see in some types of detective fiction. Often it's other people, and he's actually managing the team, but it's other people who are making the breakthroughs. And I just think that's realistic. And I think perhaps people relate to that as well.
I think that's right. And you're leading me into my next question, or really my next statement, because you have a great section on your website called The Fawley Files, extras about the series. And you lay out all the different characters. You have a map of Oxford, where different events in the books have happened. I loved poring over all of that.
Oh, thank you so much, because that's so nice to hear, because it's only just gone up, in fact. The website's only about 2 weeks old.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's really new. And I really wanted to do it, because I wanted it particularly for my American readers who obviously are coming to quite a lot of these stories and characters and the setting completely new. And I've written so much about it over the last few years when they've been coming out in the UK. I thought, I need somewhere to bring all this stuff together and to make it easier and enjoyable, actually, and fun for American readers to say, oh, let's have a look at the world that this guy inhabits. And as you say, there's the map, and there's discussions about the characters and how some of the things came about. And there's things like interviews with the advisors that I have, the police officer, the CSI, the lawyer, the people who helped me, who put these books together and get the details right. So there's profiles of them in there as well. So it just felt really nice to pull all this material together and just create something that people can explore.
I had a blast doing that. So what surprised you the most when writing All the Rage?
I think what surprised me the most, and this may be anticipating one of your later questions, for which I apologize, surprised, shocked, and appalled is actually the words I'd use, because one of the things that I wanted to explore, as I said earlier, was sort of online hate communities. And I looked in particular, and I talk in the book extensively about the incel movement, which when I wrote the book wasn't that well known. And I started, as I say, researching this sort of community and came across them almost for the first time. And even the most cursory amount of research into what was going on there, it chilled the blood. It was absolutely horrific. And I just felt very, very strongly, I mean, particularly as a woman, that this is something that we need to know more about, because unless you know that this sort of thing is happening, you can't do anything about it. So I did bring that type of community into the book, and I did replicate something like one of their chat boards. And it was just horrifying to Stephen try to write it. And it's so, so watered down compared to what you can actually find. I mean, it's bad enough in the book, but it's so much worse in real life. And I just wanted people to be aware of this because, as I say, if you can't deal with something you don't know about. But luckily, in the intervening years since the book was written, that sort of thing has become much more well known. People are able now to confront it in a way that they weren't when it was much more underground.
It was hard enough to read those portions, and I'm sure it was even more difficult to write them.
It was, I did think long and hard about whether to include it at all, just to sort of describe it rather than include it. But actually, again, I thought, no, I mean, you can describe it and people won't really get the sense of quite how bad it is. So to actually bring it right into the book and say, look, this stuff is there, and look at the consequences there are when people start behaving according to the things that they actually write, it's horrific. So yes, as I say, it was a very important thing for me to address that as part of this story.
And I'm glad you did, because I do think the way you portrayed it is much more visceral and vivid, and people are going to have a stronger response.
I think so. And I think that's good. I mean, that is good. And as I've said to you before when we've been talking, one of the things that crime fiction can do, because it's a popular format, is actually be a good vehicle for looking at some of these things, you know, the realities of what's going on around us. And of course, being crime fiction, of course, that these issues are issues that often end up causing crime. So crime fiction is a good place to look at them and see where some of these motivations for people to behave in these ways are coming from. And as I say, because it's a very popular format, it's a way of actually engaging with a lot of people about these issues.
I agree with that completely. Brings them to the forefront, makes them think about it, but they're also reading a super engaging story.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, which character was the hardest to write and which was the easiest? I think that could be a hard question for this book.
Yeah, well, we have an interesting collection of characters outside the police team. We have a group of girls who are friends with one of the victims. And that's another thing that I spend a lot of time exploring, is the relationships between these girls. And anyone, I mean, including us too, Cindy, who's been a teenage girl, knows quite how difficult that phase can be, and how, again, use the word I used before, how toxic some relationships can be between teenage girls. So that was one of the things I wanted to look at. And those characters were quite hard to write, I think, from that point of view, that I had to try and think myself back into being a teenage girl and being rather a different teenage girl to the one I hope I was anyway. Easiest to write is always Adam, because I write from the first person with him. So it's almost like he's sitting on my shoulder and talking to me, and I can always hear his voice really easily. I think perhaps some of it is because he and I have quite a similar sense of humor. So there's a certain amount of me in him, not all of me, obviously, but there's a certain amount of me. So I can sort of understand in a particular situation the sort of response he might have to it, because he's a bit like me. So, but I always enjoy writing him.
And with no spoilers, there's a big reveal about him in this one.
Yes. Well, no spoilers, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the nice things about writing a series, is that you can gradually, you know, feed out things about your characters. And that happens quite a bit, actually, sometimes. You know, you find things out about them which you hadn't known before. And I know that sounds crazy. You know, people, and I say that to people, they say, well, you know, these aren't real people. You do know that, don't you? You know, they exist in your head. And if you don't know about them, then, you know, I don't understand how that works. But it's true. A character that you've been living with, working with, writing for a long time can still surprise you. And one of the really good examples of that is, which isn't really a spoiler, which is in No Way Out, the book just before this one, where Gareth Quinn, who's the sort of Jack the Lad, you know, of the team, has a very high opinion of himself, likes to, you know, talk to the women. We find out actually that he has quite a sad backstory himself. And when he was a child, his mother had a postnatal depression. So this explains to some degree why he is like he is. He's actually quite defensive about things. And a lot of his facade is a defense mechanism. So That, well, I wasn't expecting to discover about him, but it did explain a lot about him for me, and I think for readers as well.
And gives the reader more empathy for him.
Yes, that's right, because otherwise he's in danger of being a bit of a cliche. And of course, there are people who are cliches, and that's why a cliche is a cliche. But you know, you don't want your characters to be two-dimensional or to descend into two-dimensionality just because you've seen them many times and you've run out of things to say about them. So, you know, you want to find new things to say and to just constantly surprise your reader just a little bit.
I agree. Well, now let's talk about the title, because I got to the end of the book and I just thought this title is perfect.
Well, thank you. I loved it as well. It was one of those where you sort of have a small dance around the room when you come up with it. But yes, I mean, it was just perfect. And to have the fashion angle and to have the victim, the one that's discovered on the road right at the beginning, being a fashion designer and talking a lot about her life and her ambitions to work in that industry, but then to have the rage idea as what's actually fueling what's going on in the story and what happens to her particularly, I think that meant it did fit together beautifully from my point of view without feeling forced as well, which is important.
I agree with that. But I think it makes sense at the front end. And then you finish the book and you're like, oh my gosh, from so many perspectives, actually, that title is perfect.
Yeah, well, I hope that's how it feels. That's always a nice feeling to have that sort of satisfying ending where you feel that things have come together. I particularly look for that myself as a reader. I become quite intolerant of bad endings, I think, because I try so hard not to do them myself. So I always feel slightly cheated if somebody comes up with like a supernatural explanation or something like that. I need to have all my plot lines pulled together in a satisfying way, but without it feeling like it's been forced into a shape.
I'm pretty sure we talked about this last time, because that is such a focus of mine too. It's so disappointing when you get to the end of a book and you're like, what? I read this entire book, which seemed to be plotting along well, everything was coming together, and then the ending comes out of nowhere. It drives me crazy.
Me too. I mean, there are books and very, very, very successful crime writers who I've stopped reading because they kept doing that to me. You know, the murderer turned up on the 400th page and you just think, no, that's not fair. You can't do that. That's not fair.
I agree. And it's annoying.
Very.
In addition to being frustrating, I'm just always like, oh, it makes me mad. Well, Cara, before we wrap up, what have you read recently that you really liked?
Ah, well, as we've said before, and like most other writers, one of the perks of this job is that you get early copies of things. So I've just come back from a lovely holiday, and that's when I do most of my reading these days. So I had the latest Shari LaPena to read when I was over there, which is What Have You Done?, which is fab. I mean, her stuff is always wonderful and really beautifully put together, and I really enjoyed that. I also read Anna O, which obviously has been, you know, one of those big hyped books of the last few months. And I really enjoyed it, though. We're back to endings again. I didn't think the ending worked quite as well as I was hoping. I mean, it was so, you know, really well put together and lots of wonderful suspense and such a clever premise. I was really envious of the premise. But I didn't get at the end feel that it had quite done what it could have done. But I don't want to spoil it for anyone by describing what I mean by that. But maybe other people have had the same experience.
I think they have. I've definitely heard that on Anna O, that people got frustrated by the ending.
It was very complicated. I will say that. I don't think that's giving too much away. And you know, when you're getting into the stage where you need two or three pages of explanation, I start to think, well, I'm not sure you need that much telling. You should have had more showing if you need that much telling, if that makes sense. But anyway. And the third one for you is one by Ruth Mancini, and it's called The Woman on the Ledge, and it's really, really clever. The way that, you know, the twists and turns of misdirection, where you think you're dealing with a story about X and it turns out to be a story about Y, that's really clever. So I would recommend that one as well.
I have heard that from a variety of people on the last one. And I have never read Shari LaPena, but people always rave about her books. And you're reminding me that I need to pick up one.
She's very, very good. They're beautifully written, very, very professionally done. You know, you feel you're in the hands of somebody who really knows what they're doing. And she's always coming up with wonderful angles, and there's always some sort of, you know, domestic nightmare element of them, which of course we all enjoy, don't we? But yeah, and she's an absolutely lovely person as well. So, you know, it's always nice to see someone as talented as her doing so well.
I agree with that. Well, Cara, thank you for coming on my show again. And I hope we'll get to talk when book 7 comes out as well. But this was just delightful.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, GenXGrownUp.com.
Life sucks as a grown-up.
All right, I think that was good enough.
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right.
I've never done it.
Right.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our 9th season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I would love to connect with you on Instagram or Facebook, where you can find me at Thoughts From A Page. If you enjoy the show, please consider joining my Patreon group to access bonus content and support the podcast. If you have a moment to rate the show or subscribe to it wherever you listen to your podcasts, I would really appreciate it. It makes a big difference. And please tell all of your friends about Thoughts From A Page. Word of mouth does wonders to help the show grow. The book discussed in this episode can be purchased at my bookshop storefront, and the link is in the show notes. I hope you'll tune in next time.
Science! Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes!
Woo!
Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business, when you need it, from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.